Because all the power tools, the heating, the air conditioning, and everything else will be run by our electrical principle, gravity. There will be no fuel used.
That's really good. I winced at the idea that gravity is an electrical principle. I winced at that almost as hard as I do at the use of four dimensions, as Mr. Carter uses it, without defining what he means by dimension. Now, in the mathematics, a dimension can be almost anything. It is any parameter that you choose to use for that particular operation.
Right.
Therefore, you may refer to weight as a dimension. This does not mean that it has dimensional extension in the sense that the ordinary person understands that. But without a definition of what is meant by that, it has a high-flown, almost science fiction quality that bothers me. And I wince at this, to use a certain term. To say that gravity is electrical without a much more complete explanation of the relationship between it, how you arrive at the idea that it is electrical, is something I wince
over. We didn't exactly think that it was electrical, although electromagnetism and gravity are interchangeable. What we did state is that we are going to utilize gravity as the prime mover to produce electromotive force with standard alternators and generators. And this gravity, which is a universal power and will continue to be so as long as this planet exists or other systems exist, is free and available and can be put to use. And we have found out how to do it. So that the Space Research Institute at Space Maryland will be a prototype, a plant that is run by an abundance of electricity at a production cost lower than any in history to date, unless you had a continuous wind power, which would be comparable.
Well, now, just a second. Magnetism is a force which also exists generally, and which can create electricity. But in order to generate electricity with magnets, in other words, by rotating a loop through a magnetic field, you have to put power in. You do not get it simply by rotating it. The more energy you get out, the more power you have to put in the rotation of it.
Exactly.
Well, now, why would this not apply to, if possible, to the derivation of energy from a gravitic field?
The amount that you weigh, that takes this amount of energy to lift you. Free energy can be equated in this sense, that if a man weighs 200 pounds, another man weighs 100 pounds, and if he extends a little bit farther out on a lever, he can lift this man who weighs 200 pounds with his 100 pounds. He has gained himself 100 pounds of free energy.
Not at all, because he has to move twice as far in order to lift twice as much. This is the old principle of the lever.
I know, he can be placed there.
No. In order to do the lifting, if a man at the end of a lever lifts another man with a mechanical advantage of 2-1, it is necessary for him to move twice as far as the man he moves does in order to equalize the difference in the weight. This is not any free energy. This is a strict mechanical exchange. It's like a transformer.
If he were placed there, it would be.
If he were placed there, if he were born there, if he levitated there, or if he got there any other way, the basic principles of the lever remain the same. As a matter of fact, they were thoroughly understood by the Greeks.
Right, Archimedes says, give me a lever and I'll move the earth.
Well,
the world,
Archimedes could overlook the effects of friction and several other things, and he was a little optimistic.
We have been able to apply the pressure energy of gravity, heat to motion, to produce a prime mover, which in itself will not only run many other mechanical mediums, but is an excellent prime mover for alternators and generators. Superior to anything we know being used on this planet today.
You have this machine working?
We have put this machine to many tests over long periods of time and successfully checked it out.
You have demonstrated this to others?
We have sufficiently demonstrated this that there isn't any question at all about the time of our conception and the fact that it works.
Well, Mr. Carr, in that case, I think it would be far more profitable for you to bring a working example of that up here and demonstrate it than a mock-up of the circular coil spacecraft, which is not inclined position. In one case, you'd be able to prove your theories at least to the satisfaction of the panel members here and to John, I'm sure. And you would receive a good deal of attention for that. This way, you do not receive as much because you are not demonstrating an effective thing, but only a plan.
We have to crawl before we can walk. The history of convention is usually one of disappointment. Mr. Tesla, whom we call Tesla, and will continue to do so, this is the way his name is in our memory, had well over 1,200 inventions, which I would say that at least 1,100 of them he never saw come into being, even though he lived to be in his 80 years old, well over. Television, radar, remote control guidance systems, all of these things that the world was not ready for, and therefore the world would not accept.
Now, wait a minute. The world was not ready for, or the technology at the time was incapable of producing an effective form.
That's right. The same thing.
No, no. In one case, you're implying a psychological block. In the other case, you're saying that the machine could not be built in its proper form yet.
Lester, you're dealing rather glibly in what I would characterize as a lot of semantics.
Oh, I beg your pardon. I have read your literature, and that is my basic objection. Well, we are dealing on in semantics that have...
Give me one minute of the 5 or 6 I've listened to you. I'll attempt to elucidate a little further. Much of what you have said and hypothecated just evaporates when you have to acknowledge that, as Mr. Carr said many times, nobody gets up in the morning and gives the earth a spin. Nobody lights the sun. These are free energies at work. They are constant. They have been doing the same things for as long as man's history knows about. And so in Mr. Carr's systems, he has miniaturized these motions and forces and thus produced free energies, which you have yet to see demonstrated. But if you base your assumption of no accomplishment on the facts of yesterday's knowledge, then you have to assume no advancement, no development of new technologies. Naturally, you are likely to be skeptical of things you do not already know and have not seen demonstrated. So let's not assume that a static condition must prevail wherein we base measurements on things that are standing still when we know we are in a dynamic universal system.
Oh, I agree completely. That is why I do not want to base it upon anything. I want a demonstration. I want a chance to see something operate, not to hear about the pretty principles.
May I just say this, that I think you're absolutely correct. If we move towards demonstration, we are much further advanced than a few months ago, but I can go back to history to know that Mr. Tesla, demonstrated alternating current motor for 7 years, and that he was stopped at every turn.
This I know.
And I know this, that if I were to weekly demonstrate these principles that it took so many years to develop, that they could very easily be ridiculed or laughed out of existence. I assure you that they are not going to be. I assure you that in the year 1959, which is only just a short time away, the world will see full demonstration, not just any selected group of individuals, but every person on this planet will know about the news. There is no strategic value in what we have at all, because the enemy, if there is such a thing, as well as the friend, will know about it. Now, when we are ready to make this public, this we will do, and I'm certain no one will be excluded from seeing what we state to be true, what we prove to be true, and what nobody has been able to prove that we don't have. We just are in a position where when we do it, I assure you that it will not be put on the shelf for some later date.
Well, Mr. Carr, I'd like to get back to you in a second, but first I'd like to talk to Mr. Fulton. Norman, you said that the fact that the Earth goes on spinning and the sun goes on operating indicates free energy. In a sense, the sun does, although you've got to remember that in doing so, matter is destroyed. But the spinning of the Earth...
Let me ask you, if matter is destroyed, if you are saying that the so-called laws of conservation of matter and energy have been revoked
up to this matter moment. Is destroyed in order that energy be produced.
We say dogmatically that matter is destroyed. We say that matter is transmuted.
All right, it makes no difference. Matter is destroyed in the form in which it exists and appears in another form.
Well,
certain amount of mass disappears.
In communication, all we have is what we call semantics. So I like to get common definitions and understandings of terms. So if it's destroyed, say it's destroyed. If it is not destroyed, say it's transmuted.
No, I said a certain amount of mass disappears. Therefore, the mass, which is a measure of matter...
The energy appears.
...is destroyed and energy appears.
Which is equivalent to what has been the mass.
That's right, which is equivalent to what has been the mass. And therefore, no change has been produced effectively. As far as the spin of the Earth is concerned... That does not require energy. It would require energy to slow it rather than to apply it. On the other hand, if you started tapping that, if you could conceivably put a belt around the Earth and try to run an engine off it, you would find that the Earth would have to slow down to release the energy required for your other machinery. You do not get something for nothing here. All you have is a simple application of one of Newton's laws of motion. The fact that an object in motion, and this includes rotational motion, will remain in motion unless acted on by an outside force. This does not give you free energy. This does not establish the fact that a machine can operate without energy supply. There must be some form of energy supply. Now, perhaps you have found a way of tapping an energy.
Have you ever seen a dynamo or an alternator or a motor where the assembly of elements called a commutator rotated in one direction and the assembly of elements called a field rotated in another direction?
Yes, I've seen one of those.
You've seen that. Have you also seen similar devices where the field was bolted down?
Certainly.
And not permitted to turn?
Certainly.
Well, then you see here in Mr. Carr's electrogravitational propulsion system a device in which both the action of the electrical impulse is used, and also the reaction, so that you have a much more efficient energy system than in a system where the field is bolted down, so that as the center disk rotates clockwise, you see the disk containing the field magnets and coils rotating counterclockwise, so that you have a motor here of at least double the efficiency of a motor with its field bolted down.
Not at all. It is not double the efficiency. A motor which operates on that way would not necessarily be double the efficiency, because if the original could be built 100% efficient, I mean if a single rotation could be 100% efficient, certainly a double rotating one would not be 200% efficient.
Well, a single rotation can't be
because
you set up the friction and resistance of electrical eddy currents and so on.
Let me ask you this. Would this operation be more than 100% efficient?
I don't know that I could interpret that question.
Would it produce more energy than was put into it? Would it produce more energy than was put into it?
I can answer
this.
Yes,
it could.
Yes.
Where would that energy come from?
It comes from space itself. This is the natural space force energy. In other words, this craft, a 45-foot craft that we'll take to the moon, will weigh approximately 30,000 pounds. When these two rotational forces reach a relative velocity of rotation, this entire craft will become airborne and as light as a feather as relates to gravity. This is additional energy over its function.
You say it well. You are offering to demonstrate it in a year, but meantime, All you have said is that when it happens, it happens. You have not said where the energy comes from. You have said it comes from space itself.
Right.
What is space itself? Now, there are, is energy in space, but that energy comes from the various radiations and other forces traveling through it, some of which can be tapped, but none of which are in sufficient concentration for easy tapping.
Well, let me give you a little physical demonstration of it, and you tell me what happens.
All right.
I'll show you that it is happening. Here is a small, what we call a permanent magnet.
Yeah.
I'm not putting any energy into it. As far as I know, I'm not taking any out of it. I arrange the poles of these two magnets in a certain way, and they are mutually attracted. You see them traveling through space, and I'm not putting any energy into it to make them travel.
I beg your pardon. You are. You are. The moment you pull them apart, you are supplying the potential energy for their kinetic movement later.
And space puts them back together.
No, not space. That's just plain magnetism to pull them apart. You give them the energy to return when you pull them apart.
You have to
apply energy.
It's a natural phenomenon saying it's
just plain magnetism. No, I'm not dispelling it. I am simply telling you what any physicist knows, that the energy that they have, which pulls them back together, is supplied when you pull them apart. You have to put work into the operation of separating them. That is the work or energy which goes into returning them to each other. There's no mystery to that at all.
Now we oppose these two magnets in such a way that their like poles are facing, and they push each other apart. In that case, I'm not pulling them.
In order to make it work twice, you have to, you notice. You do. They will not continue to do so. They will not continue to attract nor to repel.
Let's deal with the once of it.
Oh, no, let's not. You can have a kinetic situation, a potential situation, just as if you lift a ball off the floor to a height of 3 feet and drop it. The potential energy then becomes kinetic, and it will drop to the floor. It will not, however, keep rising and dropping the floor by itself. You have to pick it up again.
I am not evading your question, sir.
What
is the force that pushes these two magnets apart and which pulls them together without me touching
it? It is magnetism.
What is magnetism?
Some arrangement of molecules. Magnetic fields within the molecules. Somebody did.
Well, let's look at
somebody lines them up. That's what a magnet is.
Well, let's look out beyond this table a little way where somebody, as you say, has not lined up the Earth and the Moon in such a way that the great mass and weight of ocean water lifts and falls each time the Moon achieves a certain relationship to the Earth.
In other words?
Well, what you call the tides is the...
The product of the Moon's pull on the Earth.
Visual recession and accession of the water to the land as the water itself lifts and falls. These tides occur equally, identically, and oppositely on all the shores that surround a body of water. They go out at all the shores. They go in at all the shores. Simultaneously?
No, sir, that is not correct. That is definitely not correct, and that's why they have to keep local
well,
tables everywhere.
Well, let's say they're relatively simultaneously.
No, sir. They follow the
moon's path.
That's right.
Correct. Right. So it's like a swelling effect.
No, sir. It's like a movement, but not a swelling. In one place it lifts, and another place it falls.
Well, everything that lifts falls.
No, the average height of the water remains the same.
What you're saying now that water doesn't seek its own level.
No, sir. I am saying that when there is sufficient pull, it naturally responds to it. And as a matter of fact, no scientist ever said that water sought its own level, because if you put in a capillary tube, you will find that it has a curvature at the top.
Well, we're getting far away from...
You are trying to get far away by bringing up a very old principle of magnetism which any high school physicist has to learn and has to understand to some extent. This does not supply energy, neither does the moon supply energy or the Earth, except for this. The tides do require a certain amount of energy. They do not supply energy. A certain amount of energy is required, and in return for that, The motion of the moon and the earth are affected by a slight tendency to slow down over a long period of time, enough to make up for the energy required in lifting the tides and letting them drop again.
Well,
there is no creation of free energy there at all.
To sum up what you're saying, the earth supplies no energy, the ocean tides supply no energy, the moon supplies no energy, and yet we continue to find that the moon orbits the earth rotates, the earth and the moon orbit the sun,
that,
the tides rise.
That requires no energy. It would require energy for them to stop.
Well, regardless of what you
Mr.
call
Colton,
it, Mr.
have
Carr,
you ever studied any physics?
Excuse me. No. Mr. Carr
Obviously.
Has miniaturized these movements and relative forces into mechanical machines that produce similar motions and energies.
Mr. Colton,
and we are about to make
here?
Use of them in commerce and industry.
May I interrupt here? There is a thing called an orrery, which is a perfect duplication in miniature of the motion of the earth and the planet, or the moon and the planets and the sun and so on. And it certainly doesn't produce energy. You have to put energy into it. Now, his machine is hardly a more perfect duplication, or more nearly perfect, if you want to be grammatical, duplication, than this very common demonstrating machine. And frankly, I can see that it should therefore not have as good an efficiency from your description. You have brought up the subject of semantics. And yet, so far as I can find out, you have no conception of epistemological rigor whatsoever.
This is the heart of the energy system around which these other components are built. This is the inertial source of energy.
Now, wait, this has nothing to do with inertial source. Inertia is an entirely different thing. Inertia is a resistance to change of motion. You are talking semantics. That is what inertia is.
Inertia is the beginning of something.
I'm sorry, sir. Inertia is a resistance to change. Am I correct, Ben?
Right.
These things have been carefully and rigidly defined, and they have to be in order to work with them. Otherwise, you get into a semantic mess, as you seem to be getting into.
Well, let me tell you this, that Mr. Colton did not develop these machines. He has followed with me in the bringing them into being. Now, I know exactly what makes them work, because I have seen them work. I'm not at all interested in anyone's opinion of why I don't show them, including yours. These will be shown. We have publicly made the statement that they will be. We have put this in writing, and we have put it through the mails, and we have brought it to the attention of the leading scientists of this country, particularly those dealing with the government. We would not make these statements if they were not correct.
Mr. Carr, ye have said and ye have written, but ye have not demonstrated. I can think of many people who have said and who have written. I remember the old patent medicine. You don't have to take my word for it, folks. It's right here on the label. I have a seen sworn testimony.
I will come right back. Nothing. I'll just come right back to this and say that demonstration has been made. If we didn't make it to you, that may be your misfortune. But I will tell you this, that you'll read about it.
I do not care to read about it, sir, except by experts whose names I know and whose work I am familiar with, whose experience I am familiar with. I am necessarily forced to accept authority somewhere along the line, but I prefer to accept only that authority which I have found to be reliable in the past.
Well, actually,
we don't ask you to accept it. When we try to sell you stock or something, maybe we'll be obliged to prove something to you. But until then, you're just an innocent bystander, and we're going ahead with our commercial development.
Pardon me, Mr. Smith. May I interrupt for just a moment?
Come right in.
My back is facing my good engineer, Jack Keane. Is it all right, Jack? Huh? Okay. All right, fine.
No. No? No, am I on, Jack? Fine.
Here's a telegram from Claire Luce, the great actress. I believe this is a very charming lady. Dear John, please ask guests who really invented radar. Because during war in England, I drove Watson Watt
for British Air Ministries.
Oh. So. Thanks. Sorry. Apologies.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
My apologies to the person that sent this telegram.
Does anybody know the name of the gentleman who invented radar, or was this a group
Actually, there was a small group over there in England sworn to secrecy, and many of even them didn't know what they were doing, but they certainly developed the first commercial radar and gave it the name, the military radar, yeah. However, the principles are, after all, basic to the whole idea of radio.
Ray, author of the book entitled Rockets Through Space, is with us tonight. Ellery Lanier, author of the book entitled A Real Manual of Real Magic.
A Real Manual of Manual Magic.
That's it. Ben Iskowitz, the cybernetician, is with us this morning. And our good friend Dave Fields. And, of course, Sam Vandevert, the photographer. Two gentlemen from the OTC Enterprises Incorporated, located in Baltimore, Maryland, have been kind enough to stop in and join us and talk with us. Otis T. Carr, president, and the communicator, Norman Colton. I wonder if you'd be kind enough, Dave Field, to read a couple of telegrams.
All right. See if I can find one here that hasn't been read.
Anything you say. You use your own judgment, Field.
This one is from Brooklyn, New York. What steps has OTC Enterprises taken for insurance protection on their $20 million moon machine? Pardon my subjective professional curiosity and pragmatism, but we Earth insurance brokers have difficulty securing insurance coverage on simple Earth automobiles. Al Lotman.
Any comments, sir?
Well, the comment I could make is it's very peaceful out in space and very little to collide with it. We feel that once we get outside our atmosphere, we'll be much safer than we would on any street where automobiles are now on.
What about meteorites?
The chances are about one in a million of colliding with one large enough to cause us trouble.
Less than that, I think.
More or less.
Mm-hmm. Dave Field, would you read another one, please?
All right, from Brooklyn again. Ask Mr. Carr why he is associated with AMORC, Rosicrucians, which is a metaphysical group, as stated in Margaret Storm's book, when he professes to be a scientist. And this is from Saul Lipsky.
We're very happy to be a member of AMORC. Some of the most illustrious people on this planet have been members. This includes Michael Faraday, Benjamin Franklin.
Just a minute, Mr. Carr. Don't you mean the original Rosicrucians, these people were associated with them rather than the present AMORC?
Well, this cycle of it, but I think that the cycle is unbroken. There is nothing mysterious about the mystical, as we have mentioned before. It is a path of learning. It is a very happy, wonderful organization. We have found much information in there that is applicable to science. Some of the leading scientists on this earth today are members, and we never ourselves go around publicly speaking about it, but if we are asked, we're very happy to state that we are a proud member.
You mentioned this, Mr. Carr, in answer to that telegram, that there are many fine people on this planet that belong.
This
is there an
true
implication, sir, that people on other planets belong to, or rather from other planets?
There is a good possibility.
In other words, again, we're coming back in that circle that you do believe that there are people living on these other planets.
All my observations on this one lead me to believe that the other planets must be occupied by intelligences.
Mm-hmm. Why?
Because we find that life itself is indestructible. It just changes form. And inasmuch as there's been much life manifested on this planet over the centuries and the eons of time, much of it, no doubt, is now residing on some other area or some other planet. In the meantime, unquestionably, life must have originated on other planets besides our own. We're looking forward to the time when We can proudly exhibit the pin that we have worn for well over a year, which says Interplanetary Fellowship, just two words, so we can be a part of it. We're working towards it. The OTCX-1 is most assuredly going to help bring this about.
Would you want to take a moment to talk about that organization that was founded by Major Aho?
Major Aho did not found this organization of Interplanetary Fellowship. As far as I know, it isn't an organization. Somebody, I believe in Washington, and I don't recall the name, had these pins made. And it's surprising how many thousands of them are now being worn by people who, when they really study it, you can't find anything to argue about. It's interplanetary and it's fellowship. I just couldn't find anything wrong with it. But to me, it was a missing link. Why did I want to go into space? Why did I want to go to other planets? If there's not fellowship there, maybe we can establish fellowship there. Every way I look at it, it is good. I know of no such organization. I believe that Major Aho has the Washington Saucer Intelligence.
Weren't you presented with that pin by Major Aho, sir?
Yes, indeed. But I have been presented with this pin by someone else entirely, never, were not, no association with Major Aho. And I understand that somebody in Washington has had them made, and as far as I know, it isn't an organization.
Mr. Carr, again, as a scientist, as an inventor, as a pioneer in space, don't you think it's a little ridiculous to constantly tie in metaphysics into this subject, sir?
The definition of metaphysics is oftentimes loosely used.
Well, if we could use it the way we use it on the air here, and with the metaphysicians that we have up here who work with double and triple pendulums, aura meters, and what have you.
We use no devices of this kind. We do know that there is a sensitivity that our consciousness hasn't arrived at. We do know that there are adept people on this planet who know about these sensitivities. We know that it has been previously demonstrated on this planet that man has much greater potential than his ordinary physical senses. And all of these things are, in a sense, will be science in the future, which now are classified oftentimes loosely as metaphysics. I think that the true scientist keeps an open mind. When someone sincerely says, this experience happened to me, he does not say, oh, it didn't happen to me, therefore it doesn't exist. A true scientist is a man who is willing at all times to possibly explore. Now, in our business, in the application of these principles, we had the rare good fortune to know Dr. Albert Einstein. We had the good fortune to know Nikola Tesla. And we knew that Mr. Tesla received inspiration from a source that was almost difficult to define.
You knew this at 20 years of age, sir?
Absolutely. Within a very short period of time. In fact, he and I run an experiment that proved that man had much greater qualifications.
Could you tell us something about this experiment, sir?
Mr. Tesla said that we were primarily an electrical machine, that we had so degenerated our bodies that we didn't even know how to apply the principles that were available if we wanted to put them to work. He said, let us go back to the great master who said, we must be born again.
Tesla said this to you,
yes.
20-year-old boy?
21 by this 21. Time.
All right,
I'd so. been with him a year. He says, let us go back and see what was this great statement. We must be born again of water and the spirit. Well, what is the spirit? It's the air that we breathe. And water, a liquid of the same. Two elements. Let's see if we can apply them electrically. What is a human body but a possible electrical potential machine? So let's see what we can do with it. So we run a 3-month experiment wherein no alcohol, no cigarettes, no tobacco, no stimulants of any kind.
Water?
Water and plenty of breathing.
You couldn't even exist if you didn't breathe.
I mean, right.
This is not
all
an
right.
Experiment.
Now, Mr. Tesla also further said, what is the best electrical insulator that we know of? It is porcelain. And what is the best porcelain there is? The teeth. Maybe the teeth weren't made to tear with as animals. Maybe these teeth are insulators. Maybe the spoken word has had enough electricity behind it to be heard around the earth. And vibration. So, he says, let's see what we can do. He said, maybe when we have our mouth closed, the circuit is open. And when we open our mouth, the circuit is closed. Positive charges of electricity come from above, and the negative from the ground. See, we combine these two forces. It was a very interesting experiment, and we got very good results.
What were the results, sir?
These would be classed as metaphysical.
Well, that would be something difficult for me to understand. May I ask you this, Mr. Carr? I think you've been a rather fortunate man, being able to be associated with Tesla during the time that he was alive, and with Einstein, and... I mean, this is something. I was just wondering, have you ever had the opportunity of kicking this around with Wernher von Braun?
Mr. von Braun, unquestionably, is a dedicated man.
I had no doubt of that.
He started on a principle of quick energy, reaction, rocket principles the Chinese have known about for centuries.
No,
and
sir.
Abandoned
entirely
some
different
of
rocket principles.
Well, anyway, rockets. And Newton's evaluation is the same, and certainly achieved a whole lot. He could very easily have joined forces in Europe, but he chose America instead. And unquestionably, has been a dedicated man in the rocket field. He will be the first man to congratulate us when he sees our craft arise, which is an entirely different principle from which he has spent a lifetime on.
He'll be
on.
The first man to congratulate you?
I believe so, yes.
You mean he'll be on the moon when you get there, or what?
You
mean he'll congratulate you at Space, Maryland?
That's right.
Yeah, I see.
We feel this. We honestly feel that he is a dedicated scientist.
So that wasn't my question, sir. My question, again, if I may repeat it, Mr. Carr. You've had the pleasure of talking and associating with many great scientists. And I was not aware of the fact that Tesla was interested in metaphysical subjects. However...
He didn't consider metaphysical.
Oh, he didn't?
No.
No, I see. This is a recent label.
I said what results we had may be considered metaphysical.
I see, fine. What about Wernher von Braun? Have you ever had the chance of sitting down and cutting a few jackpots with him?
None whatsoever.
Ben, you had a question.
Yeah,
I want to give Lester a chance.
Mr. Carr. You said you knew Dr. Albert Einstein?
Yes, indeed.
This is an association that continued over some length of time?
We started with correspondence, and he was kind enough to give me an interview.
Maybe it's just hopping on my part. But, I mean, I once met Dr. Albert Einstein spoken for about 10 or 20 minutes.
This is about the length of my interview.
I would never say I knew him.
Always felt like I did, because having followed so much of his writings and having been so much in agreement, particularly with his feelings about humanity, his philosophy, that somehow or other he didn't feel like a stranger to me. So when I began to have some success with some of my experiments, we were building the first circular foil models right here in New York City in 1938. And we come up against some interesting things that had been led to us, or that we were led into this type of research by the inspirations of Mr. Tesla before. We started to correspond with the good doctor, and he was very patient when we told him we were trying to build a spaceship. And he gave us a clue that has stayed with us and has made it possible to now know the success is here. He said it is impossible for man to go out into space and return unless he carried his own force field with him. And I had never given this a thought previously.
I thought so, Luke?
Absolutely. And this was, I would say, 39 or 40. I don't remember when.
Didn't Tesla say something very similar to this?
Well, he never said it to me. All he ever said to me was, you have to have electricity.
Didn't he say something about you need a free universal source of energy?
That's right, electricity. But the doctor was talking about something else, something to protect the ship against friction.
I wanted to ask you about this part of the literature that we have here from the OTC Enterprise Incorporated. This is Information Bulletin Number 3, December 23rd, 1967, where it is bulletin talking about the scientific verification of the principles of the circular coil spacecraft. And you describe what the principles of it are. And there's a sentence here that intrigues me. It says, these statements in evaluation of natural physical phenomena as first discerned and made public by Mr. Carr have been physically tested in laboratory experiments by an impartial scientific laboratory. Are you at liberty to give the name of that laboratory?
I think so. What happened is that when our literature was released, this technical firm is building data evaluation equipment under subcontract to missiles and so forth, run a test predicated upon our statements. And they verified this test and wrote us and were quite excited about it. They're in California, and they voluntarily wrote us to tell us that they had tested out this principle and found it to be correct. We were very happy. We went, had interviews with them, started a collaboration. It might well have ended up in them building the first OTCX-1, but it did not materialize.
Are you at liberty to give the name of the laboratory?
Mr. Colton handled these details. I'll leave it up to him. He is the man that's...
Yes, it's the Electromation Company of Santa Monica, California.
Electromation?
Yes, they're the people who, I understand, have originated such things as the... a device known as the semantic intercorrelator, manufactured by such people as Bendix Aviation Corporation, and
that
which are used.
Fascinating. What is the semantic intercorrelator?
Well, like your cybernetic machines that figure things out and give answers and control devices of other kinds.
But, I mean, how does it get the name semantic intercorrelator? It's a great name.
Introduce something here. I don't know anything about it, but they were so happy in describing it to me, they actually called it a thinking machine. This machine was fed a vocabulary.
The semantics of the car.
Yes. This machine was fed a vocabulary. And having the vocabulary, when it was asked questions, not only pulled out the words defining the question according to vocabulary, but added some of their own. This is why they called it a thinking machine. They have had some very unusual experiences with it.
I have never heard of this machine. I would certainly like to find out more about it.
Mr. Gerald Blackburn is manager of... Blackwell is the general manager of the Electromation Company, and he was certainly most enthusiastic about what they had accomplished with this.
Does this have anything... Is this machine and is its principle... Are its principles somewhat dissimilar as... Similar
it has nothing to do with ours at all.
No, not yours. I'm thinking of another machine called an electronic interoperator.
I wouldn't know, sir. I really wouldn't.
Well, there is a point in the... again, in the information bulletin. We're actually going on saying that the principles have been physically tested and verified by an impartial scientific laboratory, laboratory and confirmed as follows. I'd like to read this part and from the quote. It is a quote from the laboratory. We have shown that a charged body accelerated to an axis rotation relative to its attractive inertial mass indicates polarity in a given direction. The dip needle points, say, up toward the top of the body, but mount this whole rotating body with its spindle on another platform and rotate this platform on a spindle. And if the counter rotation is greater than the initial forward rotation of the body, a dip needle on the second platform will point down, while the first dip needle points up, indicating the complete relativity of polarity. When the exact counter rotation matches the forward rotation, the body loses its polarity entirely and immediately becomes activated by free energy. And then in parentheses, you have the word tensor stresses in space, close parenthesis, and acts as an independent force. Now, I will tell you frankly that I understood nothing in that entire paragraph except I saw a familiar word called tensor. Are you referring to tensor analysis?
No, they made that reference. Our statement was very plain, where we said any body of a magnetic field which was activated to a relative rotation to its larger mass, which is its attractive mass, would become airborne or levitate. And this is what our ship does.
In other words, the word tensor was used by them.
It was used by them. That's not by me.
Lester, do you understand that paragraph?
No, I certainly do not, except that it seems to be a hyped up and very fancy way of saying something which isn't very surprising at all. If you take a coil of wire and rotate it in a field, it naturally will generate electrical current, and you will also have magnetic fields along any place where the current is. If you now take one and rotate it in the opposite direction, you can actually get two opposing flows of current in such a manner that a dip needle isn't affected by it. But this is nothing very unusual.
Oh, they balance each other out.
Yes, and this is certainly nothing very remarkable. It's something that was pretty well understood 100 years ago, as I would get it. Can you make anything else out of it?
Well, what they further did was take the actual discs and rotate them in this field where they became mutually conductive, therefore became polarized the same, and then they become levitated. This is not new knowledge except as we apply it by energy from within. This is new and novel. Had the first developers of storage electrical cells made these a piece of machinery and put them in motion, this development would have come here, much sooner than that.
Mr. Carr, I have been looking at that fascinating model over and over again, and there are some questions that leap to my mind that I have been trying to repress, but, you know, to ask them, I think, would only reveal my ignorance in these matters, but... I can no longer repress them. I remember in talking to John, you were talking about a 12,000-volt storage battery was going to activate the coils and therefore the iron rods, the coils around would become electromagnets.
Uh-huh.
And this would rotate in one direction while the inner... capacitor plate and then the
regenerative coil.
The regenerative coils would rotate in the opposite direction. Now, the thing I do not understand is that I can understand the 12,000-volt battery charging up the magnet.
Mm-hmm.
But what is moving the magnets in one sphere and causing the wheel container
to activate these coils from the battery also. All three circuits there are activated from the battery, from the center power source. And then naturally, the minute that you run electric current through conductors in a magnetic field, you get polarity of the same, and when you do, you get repulsion, which is what a motor is. So these begin to turn. As they do in their rotation, they also become regenerating. We conduct this back through a regulator back into the battery. Now, what is rather unusual in these coils that you're seeing is that they are not only a vortex, but a vertex. which means that we have here, as far as I know, for the first time in electrical history and application, an expansion and contraction coil. We have been able, in this development, to utilize something that, so far as we know, has not been used in electrical machines, the eddy current. And this is done by dimension and form, just as much as it is done by other systems incorporated. Being able to utilize the eddy current, we are able, so far as I know, for the first time, to increase permeability of ferromagnetic substances over what was grasped as their saturation point. This is a novel secret discovery of this development. We are confident that when this knowledge has been made public and applications of these principles are concerned, that this knowledge applied in the communications field will set up something almost fabulous.
As I take it, Mr. Carr, you really have something. The power plant is really some sort of electric generator and electric motor combined.
Right.
Now the
both.
Now the
self-contained battery.
With a self-contained battery.
Mm-hmm.
Now the thing that I wanted to ask was, no electrical machine. I mean, not just electrical machines are 100% efficient. So therefore, part of your energy that you're manufacturing, you'll always be losing. I mean, even if it's a minute percentage, it will be seeping away. So therefore, if you
start... Our machines wear out.
No, I don't mean the wearing out. I mean, all machines wear out.
Personal losses.
Yeah.
But what I was thinking of is that, say, you start out saying 100% energy is being delivered. So you're getting back, say, 99%. And then on this 99% on the next cycle returning, you're getting 98%. Won't the thing eventually stop revolving?
Yes, indeed. We hope to go long distances before it wears out.
Oh, I see. The cycle is that long.
That's right.
I was wondering about this. Comparison leaps to my mind. I'm not being facetious, but the comparison does leap to my mind is that, in effect, this combination motor and generator and the fact that you have such a tiny loss of energy in returning the output into the input, was that I was wondering whether or not you feel or that you think you have here a perpetual motion machine.
Absolutely not. The energies are perpetual because our machines wear out, and any energies that we put into them that's a store will eventually weaken and wear out.
I see.
We don't understand perpetual motion man-made.
I see.
Dave, I wonder if you'd be kind enough to read those two telegrams there.
Yes. This one is from New York. I am sick unto revulsion of the double talk of your guests. Bravo to Del Rey. From Lawrence Lemoyne.
Thank you. That's very nice. From my point of view.
Well, that's nice for you. Yes, okay. Here's another one from Brooklyn. Along, John, tell Mr. Carr he can read expose on AMORC in issue of Equilibrium, which will be sent to him in Long John from Saul Lipsky.
Solomon, we'll be able to read it. Thank you. We're sitting around cutting up a few jackpots with... Jack Keane. My apologies. We certainly missed our good friend Al Nielsen, and I'm happy to say that the great inventor, that scientist, that man among men, the great Keane, has been with us all morning. And if you've listened, you've heard the difference. He's pretty well locked up. Sorry, Jack, I didn't mean it.
Dave Field has been with us too, so that sort of gives a credit to all of those, and of course, that old communicator.
See, that's a wonderful sign. I think we could write a sign of that, huh? That old communicator. Norman Colton is with us from OTC.
Trying to find a rhyme, John.
The communicator, huh?
Yeah.
See, there must be something.
Alligator.
No.
Levitator.
Oh, that's pretty good.
Otis is wild tonight. That's right in there.
That old levitator, that old communicator, Norman the Colton.
You know, one of the most famous rhymes Otis has made is one that goes something like, if there is no time and there is no space, there can't be any other place. If there is no near and there is no far, perhaps the universe is right where you are. This is silly-sounding doggerel to some people at first glance, but Ben was saying something before about the dynamic and the static, and so maybe there's a lot of little profundities in this little rhyme.
You did say something. I remember.
You dynamic and static?
Yeah, I don't know just how you said it.
Dr. Einstein tried to picture a universe without motion. Dayfield, we're going to give you an opportunity with a couple of questions. You've been sitting on the sidelines there. Would you care to ask Mr. Carr or Mr. Colton a question? You're welcome to do so, Dave.
Let me tell a little secret on Dave before he asks his first question. Behind your back, he was punning on his name by revolving in your chair, calling himself a rotating field. I want to ask him if he's a rotating magnetic field.
Well, I'm called that very often in school with my friends who are physics and engineering students, and they joke about it. I thought it was a perfectly good opportunity to repeat it.
Well, I thought it deserved a public laugh, so there you have it.
Well, thank you.
Now, that doesn't mean you can't ask questions.
No, because I
communicated, you know.
I have a question which was brought up when Lester and Norman were having a mild discussion before about the free energy involved in the magnet and the earth. I was just thinking of an analogy that I'd like to make. It appears, I think, that there is free energy from the earth and the moon and the tides. But let's think, suppose we were had a pendulum here on earth which was suspended from a very long wire. Now, we can say that one of these pendulums would swing for a long time before stopping, even as far as we're concerned. Now, let us imagine that on the surface of this pendulum there is not a universe, but some people or beings living on the surface of this pendulum. And their masses are infinitesimal compared to the mass of the pendulum. Now, any force that they could exert or remove or try in when they're trying to take any energy out of the swing, out of the motion of this pendulum, would appear to them as if they would have no effect upon it. And somehow this seemed to me as a similar thing. In other words, the earth is so large. I remember learning that if you jump on the earth moves away from you a little bit, just as much as you, in proportion, that is, as you move away from it. Of course, we can't measure it. But, I don't know, maybe this is a product of logic courses in school or brash young men showing off their new knowledge. But I just thought of it, and let's see what you think of it.
Can I make a little nasty crack here? Is young men showing off knowledge?
Go ahead, Lester.
Dave, don't you think that a thing which can be described in a Bessel function would soon be obvious to the inhabitants?
Lester, I have to admit...
Pardon me, is that permitted when you hear that type of language? You know, we're on the air.
Well, the pendulum may be described basically as a damp wave train.
That's a dirty.
I'm just playing dirty. I'm being nasty.
It is forbidden for me to divulge any more information.
I'm not telling
you. Okay, Dave.
You know, this by the way, what Dave said, that when you jump on the earth, the earth moves away from you, it's a potential amount.
In proportion to the mass.
And I was thinking, you know, if you had everybody together, you know, three o'clock in the morning, you said, you know, this is jumping off time, you know? And you got everyone together in the whole world, you know, all the Eskimos and all the Chinese and all the Russians and all the Americans and all the South Americans. And you said, exactly 3 a.m., everyone jumped.
and you multiply that by the 2 billion people in the world, we may go into orbit. Very good.
The best thing to do is to assemble them all and have them jump across the international date line.
Well, you'd have to lose 2 days. Dave, you've got a chance for one or two more questions. Either you may address them to Mr. Carr or to Mr. Colton.
At this point, again, the profound questions that I had intended to ask upon consideration, I feel that at this point, again, I should wait, because perhaps some other fine point may be brought out by Lester Del Rey.
Well, they performed a seal nisi bonum, but nevertheless.
Lord! You come out with Bethel function, now you're quoting Latin. Well,
you don't think I had an education, Ben?
Boy, oh boy.
I staggered very reluctantly through Fourier
stuff. And that's rough, as you probably know.
Fourier integral?
I said I staggered through them.
Well, someday you gotta explain them to me.
Oh, I don't know.
I think I'll stick to communication.
I'm with you, Colton. I'm with you.
Hello,
I've got a couple of little things, but if somebody else wants to take over,
Do you
want
to say something, Scott? Well, the only thing I was going to say is that in all of this mathematics of where there does seem to be an infinity of numbers, that our little experiments have brought us the attention.
Mr. Clark, I interrupt just for a moment. I want to warn you. Yeah, I'm asking, I'm pleading for my sake. You came out with a formula that we both discussed. It was minus zero, plus zero, or the minus zero equals zero.
Right.
I got so many letters saying, why didn't you stamp this ruthless heresy out at the beginning and all the rest? And I think I brought out clearly. And you later on said that it was spiritual, the phrase. Who's spiritual alive? Well, it was not mathematical. But if you're going to go into, would you please say, before you go into your kind of mathematics that I am dissociated from it, so I won't get any more of these letters saying,
well,
that you agreed with him and you did this and all the rest of it.
I'm going to state this, that we start teaching children linear measurement with a rule, usually 12 inches, and everybody knows that the rule has imperfections, so that the first inch is not exactly 1 inch. So if it is a thousandth off, by the time he's got to the 12th inch, he has amplified imperfections. There is no thought of teaching correlation. So we've invented, which we will use at OTC Enterprises, a rule to try a little bit to overcome these imperfections of measurement. We claim that a rule should start in the center with zero and measure to the right and to the left. Being positive one on one side and negative one on the other, so that the imperfection of the measurement on the right will be correlated with the imperfection of the measurement on the left, so that we will get closer to a true measurement and not keep on amplifying mistakes. Mathematician.
Well, whether or not you call, let's say, whether you call it minus, I mean, like you're making a rule, whether or not you call the center zero and the one below it minus one, the one above it plus one. I mean, is any difference in calling it six, the one below it five, and the one
all
above
all the difference
seven?
In the world, because they measure from left to right when they should measure from the center to right and left.
Well,
now, this is what is done with the
standard, internet. There's a standard 12-inch rule at the Bureau of Standards in Washington, D.C., which is kept as accurate as possible.
But they admit imperfection.
Yeah, it's a 1/1,000,000,000 of an inch or something.
So, if we can...
But you never can get it accurate.
But if we take the imperfection on one side and match it with imperfection on the other...
Wow,
how
but
how
can
you
know
you're
sure?
Matching correctly? If you start from the center, it will be much closer.
Not necessarily. Your errors might cancel or they might combine. For instance,
they might magnify.
The protractor or the compass, more or less, gives us as close to a measurement because we're going from right to left from a point. Now, if the rule starts out this way, we feel that a true sense of measurement will be much better understood than it is by the present method of continuing to accent and amplify our error.
There are much better ways of overcoming the error. There are a great many other ways of doing it. I cannot see that this accomplishes anything except to change the terminology and make it in such a case awkward enough so that you have to add -1 to +1 to get +2.
Well, it works out very nice. It works very nicely.
I am saying that if this kind of a rule is used, that would have to be. This is not the normal procedure, of course.
We have to always move away from normal procedure to have novelty and invention.
I wanted to ask you, gentlemen, either one of you, a question. Have you ever heard of the I Am movement?
I can answer my part of that quickly and say I've heard of it, but I don't know what it is. You know?
Same. I've heard of it, and I don't understand.
The reason I asked that question, I've been extremely interested in getting some people from that movement. That's the old Ballard movement. They had they started out in California.
Is there any something like that?
No.
There's a few connections there. Actually, people, I understand, paid as much as $500 to $1,000 to spend a day on Mount Shasta.
And they would think of a question, and rocks would roll down a portion of the mountain there and hit the side of the cabin. If you heard a group of rocks fall down and then you heard no additional sound, that was yes. If the rocks came rolling down and then stopped, and a few minutes later more rocks came rolling down, that was no.
Did you just wear out the mountain as a while?
No, I understand that they were using nylon rocks.
Well, I went around Mount Shasta in 1922 in March in a blizzard on a gondola.
Hello,
didn't like to do that again.
A gondola?
We weren't looking for any rocks.
A waterborne gondola?
Boxcar, steel gondola.
Yeah, railroad car.
Yeah, railroad car.
May I read this first?
Go ahead.
I will place my hand up to my ear and cup my hand
in the professional.
Look at me. See? I mean, this is pro. This is pro. When you do this, you know, when you see anybody doing this, you know this man is with it. He's a real pro.
That's how you get those parasite problems. I understand the workings of an IBM machine. However, it is not necessary for me to be a snob to operate one. That is one of the reasons I don't like brainway of talking on your program. This is from Philadelphia.
There's a little hotbed of occultists down there. That's just rise up in their spiritualistic realm.
I have a great surprise for you.
Stamp out Philadelphia.
What you've done tonight?
Four solid miles of rubble left there.
Pardon. Before you came on the program tonight, you were a little late. May I just say this to you, that when Mr. Carr and Mr. Colton came to the studios after we greeted each other, talked for a couple of minutes, Mr. Colton said, will Ben be here? And I said, yes, he'll be here a little later. And they said that they had a surprise. They are hoping that you will come to Baltimore the latter part of December at your convenience, and they intend to give you a plaque.
And this is going to be a gala event.
John.
Gala.
Is that a marble plaque?
What's that?
Is that a marble plaque?
It's in the shape of a headstone.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
No, really, I think these people in Philadelphia, you know, they overstepped their bounds because, you know, I've just been asking questions tonight. I haven't said, you know.
But Ben, may I ask a question?
I've just been asking questions, and it's my right to ask questions.
May I ask one question?
I'll fight to the death for my right to ask questions.
May I ask a question?
Why
is it that not only Philadelphia, but everybody seems to hate you all the time,
I'm
Ben?
Very well loved. I'm a very nice guy. I have lots of friends.
You have?
I have lots of friends.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I was worried about you.
People like me. I mean, this is a strange thing for you Philadelphia but there are people who have been known to sit down and drink a cup of coffee with me. People have.
You didn't provide the coffee, though.
No, I have even been bought the coffee occasionally.
No, not from a machine, I'm sure.
you're starting that again.
May I start to wrap it up, man? I would just like to repeat this. I'm going to make it as brief as possible because I think that our guest this morning, Mr. Colton, Mr. Carr, will enjoy this little tale. When we went out to the spacecraft convention in Lebanon, New Jersey, our good friend Ben Iskowitz was really amazed, pleasantly so, to see the number of people that wanted to shake hands with Ben and take his picture and ask for his autograph, because they'd heard him on the party line. And this was quite a thrill. And certainly anyone can understand it. Well, recently, Ben decided that he would like to get a new apartment. He's not particularly happy in his present apartment. He'd like a little larger apartment, some changes. So, a couple of Sundays ago, it was a rather nasty day, and he decided to spend some time. He was doing some reading, and he had the copy of the New York Times, and he went through the section devoted to real estate, and he discovered there were two or three apartments in the village. The locations were ideal, and he thought he would call the real estate agents and get more information the following day, which would be Monday. So Monday afternoon, he called one particular real estate agent, and the lady answered, and he said he would like additional information about the apartment located at such and such address. And the lady said, well, to be very frank with you, we have a young couple, they were just here a couple of minutes or so. They left, and they're going to call me back in an hour, and they would like to have it, but they can't give a definite answer for an hour. However, if they decide not to take it, I'll be happy to call you back. So Ben was quite enthused after hearing the details of the about the apartment, and he gave his name. He said, my name is Iskwith. Isquith. And the lady said, Iskwith? There can't be two men with that name. And Ben said, what do you mean? And she said, what is your first name? He says, Ben Iskwith. And she says, oh, you're on the Long John program. Well, of course, he was very elated because he figured, gee, I'm in like Flint. Certainly, I'm going to get the apartment. She possibly will even put two coats of paint on the kitchen. And so he was very happy about it. And all of a sudden she said, you know, you're a very intelligent boy, but I don't like you. I think you're nasty, and I would never rent an apartment to
poisonous
Ben Iskwith.
Poisonous, the worst.
And this was actually what happened to Ben.
Poisonous, that's the worst.
So I think on that note, we'll wrap it up for another morning. Let me remind you that our good friend, the great Phil Thompson, will be along in just a few minutes. And Phil always has interesting material, and I want you to keep that dial set at 7:10, and you listen to Phil. That's our Sunrise Serenader.
Well,
and, of course, at 6 a.m., John A. Gambling, the gentleman that is responsible for music from Studio X. Yes, Ben?
I just want to say that even the Libby's going cracked out there.
That was Dennis. I love the people in Philadelphia, and thanks for listening. Otis P. Carr has been with us this morning. Norman Colton, Lester Del Rey, Ben Iskwith, Ellery Lanier, Dave Field, Sam Vandenberg, our engineers Jack King and Russell Tinklepore. I'll be back with you again tonight at midnight. I sincerely hope that you'll be with me If you're getting up, I hope you have a wonderful day. And if you're going to bed,
get a good night's sleep. And sleep real good. Bless you.